Welcome to the Better Money, Better World Show, a podcast project of Impact Capital Managers, or ICM. ICM is a group of investors who believe that by solving the world's greatest challenges, we will generate market-leading returns for investors while bending the arc of human history towards sustainability and justice. ICM members have backed companies ranging from Tesla to Coursera to Vital Farms. Collectively, ICM's 100-plus members manage over $90 billion. I'm your host, Daniel Pianco, a co-founder of ICM. My day job is as co-founder of Achieve Partners, a leading investor in education and human capital. Here on Better Money, Better World, we'll explore the stories of our investor members, the companies we're building, and the limited partners allocating money to investors who don't just seek alpha, but also to leverage their capital to build a better world. Welcome, Rika, to the Better Money, Better World podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. Nice to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yes, it is important to note the changing of the seasons and the year. This is the first interview of 2024. So thank you very much. And we've got a big, really important question to start off, which is everyone sort of knows or has heard of Nuveen and TIAA, but can you talk about how they fit together and how you fit in that and how Nuveen is launching its second impact fund?
Yeah. So Nuveen is the wholly owned asset manager of TIAA, which is a fairly well-known financial services company, which is focused on retirement savings for those in various fields like education, healthcare, et cetera. Nuveen has had the privilege of being the asset manager for TIAA and then has helped invest both TIAA's capital, which is over $350 billion of capital on behalf of retirees, but also bringing that expertise to investors, institutional wealth, as well as kind of sovereigns and foreign investors, using the same strategies, which are long-term in nature. And so Nuveen, as an asset manager, which manages today over $1 trillion of AUM, manages pretty much every single asset class across publics, privates, alternatives of various types. And within the alternatives asset class, the business I lead, which is Nuveen Private Equity Impact, we manage a little over $1 billion within this strategy, which has been built up since 2012. In fact, even pre-2012, when I joined, there were some investments made with focus on impact in private equity, and I've had the good fortune of kind of being able to build up this franchise over this past decade. So we manage assets on behalf of TIAA, our parent. That was our pre-fund one portfolio, where we've been investing focused on climate and inclusion in the growth equity space. And then in 2020, raised our fund one, which is now fully invested, and now raising fund two, which is the Nuveen Climate Inclusion Fund two.
So you have quietly built one of the largest private equity portfolios in impact investing. Congratulations. Do you think that this has been it sort of almost seems buried within such a large asset manager, it may not have gotten the light of day that it deserves. Can you talk a little about how you're talking about the Nuveen story and sort of how that is one of the biggest impact stories we may not have heard of?
Well, I think we have, you know, enough notoriety and recognition amongst kind of our investee companies and the partners we work with. And frankly, I think given the focus, which has always been intentionally backing companies that are creating solutions to problems like climate change and inclusion, we have been okay with not having all the fame associated with it and really focused on the doing. The idea is that this company that we have been able to build this practice within is very much aligned to impact investing as a philosophy, just given the DNA of the parent company, the long-term nature of investing, our retiree participants that have always thought about social value and environmental value as part of kind of their retirement accounts. And so the DNA of the company has allowed us to build this investment practice in a deliberate way before, you know, the industry became what it is today. And as the industry continues to grow, we think our role is to continue to evolve and play in parts of the market that continue to face what we call capital gaps, both from a impact perspective, from a deal-making perspective, and continuing to do that with the intentionality of, you know, profits and purpose being at the core of how we operate.
Let's talk about the capital gap, because you are operating in a place that a lot of other folks are not. So can you talk about the capital? Where in the capital stack are you operating, and why do you think there aren't? And what makes you unique in that sector?
There's a couple things that make us unique. One is our focus on areas of climate and inclusion, and increasingly backing companies that are working in the nexus of climate and inclusion. As we all know now, climate change has been widely accepted as being one of the biggest existential crises facing humanity. And both as customers, consumers, market participants, we all have to do something about it. And there is a lot of momentum, I think, around the climate agenda today. One might argue not enough, but still positive progress. And we think that in that space, there's a lot of different players. There's obviously infrastructure and generation plays that are very much important and very large scale in nature. There's venture capital plays that are kind of backing companies who are being created to solve climate change in a different way. There's still a lot of work needed in two areas. One, thinking about climate change from a global perspective, carbon emissions or emissions and waste, no borders at the end of the day, right? We cannot ring fence America's climate issues from India's climate issues. We think that the capital gaps exist in two ways. One, from a stage perspective, backing companies that are graduating from venture, but are not quite ready for middle market control or public market transactions, where significant minority stakes with aligned investors to back companies for their next phase of growth, which is doing what they do well with strong unit economics, but serving more customers and expanding scale and size and capacity. That's one. And those deal sizes, in our view, are kind of sub $50 million check sizes, right? Which is where we feel very comfortable playing. The other bit is, focus on parts of the world where we think climate change interventions are needed and growing rapidly. India, for instance, is a big market where we focus. So roughly half of our portfolio is based here in the U.S. And I'd say the remainder half is India. We have invested in a couple of other countries, but really these are our two anchor markets. And you think of a country like India, you take the population of the United States and then add 1 billion people, and that's India. You have a serious growing middle-income consumer, significant energy needs, and a strong commitment from the country, both private sector and public sector, around climate transition and green transition, which requires dollars spent. To us, when we look at that population, we've made some investments in companies that are either bringing an inclusion framework, bringing financial services to low-income customers, but then thinking of ways to drive and help the green energy transition for those customers. Or in other instances, we've backed companies in the climate tech space who are focused on the marginalized segments of society, particularly folks like farmers, smallholder farmers in India. So that's another area which we think still kind of the check size combined with the global focus makes us slightly unique. And we like the deal flow there. We have had tons of experience both as a team as well as kind of through our portfolio companies in the country. And then finally, now I think bringing the thesis of low income and inclusion with climate is particularly exciting for us. We think, even in a country like the U.S., one in four households doesn't have access to safe and affordable housing, which means they spend more than 50% of their income on rents. When they do that, they're typically living in multifamily housing, subsidized housing in various types. And they don't have access to clean energy, for instance, right? They're participating in the grid as provided to them. So we look at opportunities to serve a role in backing companies that are bringing climate transition opportunities for the low income customer, driving that market, in addition to kind of the good work that's going on at the utility scale. Really, I think the capital gaps to us really both are an investment opportunity, but also parts of the market that we think are going to continue to grow at a rapid pace to solve this broader climate change issue.
Can you give sort of an example of a company that you feel really epitomizes both of those?
Well, I have a couple. So maybe I'll start with a company in India that we backed over a year ago called EcoZen. The company at its core is a light manufacturer of solar-powered water pumps, small-scale water pumps, as well as cold storage units, serving the smallholder farmer in India. The product has been value engineered to be cost effective or purchased by that smallholder farmer and is essentially serving a part of the Indian population that is a big part of GDP. The ag sector today contributes over 60% to India's GDP. but agriculture in India is still largely smallholder farmer based, so under 2 hectares per parcel of land. So the economies of scale do not really apply to a smallholder farmer. The Porter's 4-5-4 typically work against the farmer. And one of the things that they struggle with is irrigating their land. Most Indian farmers actually are not connected to the grid, and India is not about to draw traditional power lines to every single farm. In some ways, the Indian ag and energy story is going to be very similar to the mobile story in India, you know, where now everyone has a mobile phone, and solar is going to really help drive that transition. And so when you look at that paradigm, you know, being able to irrigate a small parcel of land using solar power, where the sun shines quite a bit in that part of the world, and being able to have a controller that's installed with IoT that gives you analytics around, you know, how much usage you can get from a certain number of hours of sunlight a day, being able to get analytics on the depth of the well that's been born, the quality of the water, the brackishness of the water, and do so remotely using mobile devices is something that is, you know, very productively helpful to the Indian farmer. So that's one product line. And then the second pain point for an Indian farmer of many is access to kind of markets post-harvest. And, you know, there's a market clearing price typically when you don't have the ability to store and or kind of, you know, access markets directly, where you just kind of, you harvest and you just sell them for whatever price you get in the market that day. And I typically for fruits, vegetables, and other perishables, you know, there is a value accretion if you're able to hold at the right time to sell the market when the price is more favorable. And but cold storage doesn't quite, climate control cold storage doesn't really exist in India, once again, due to this kind of utility, you know, grid disconnection problem. The small scale cold storage with solar PV on top, that's kind of shipping container size or smaller for groups of farmers to be able to utilize to kind of store their goods is another part that can be really helpful. And also along the grocery value chain, right? There's a lot of food wastage happen, not just, you know, in India, but in many parts of the world, from kind of farm to table, if you will. And this limits that as well. So we backed this company, EcoZen, really with the thesis that they were providing a green product into the market, which was really useful, but also serving a farmer. And we just, as part of our diligence, determine also the value accretion to that farmer. So, you know, we backed this company with a little under $15 million of growth capital at a time when they had reached profitability, but had significant total addressable market to serve and needed aligned capital to do that. The company has more than doubled in size in terms of revenue and bottom line in this past 12 months, not just because of our capital, but frankly, just because of the sheer size of that market and a very strong product fit. So that's one example that that epitomizes a cool investment that, you know, combines climate and inclusion for us.
So it's a combination of geography, stage of deal, but also you're looking where I think it sounds like a lot of people aren't looking. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I would say I don't know that people aren't looking at India.
No, I meant the very specific, like, you know, hey, we're helping the Indian agriculture market. That's not a strategy I've heard. The small ag market is not normal PE size deals.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a New York PE size opportunity, but certainly, listen, I think it's taken years of investing in the country and understanding the ecosystem and having invested in adjacent sectors to have found this company interesting and backing it. But yeah, there's also kind of a deal size element to it, right? You know, our diligence and all of that looks very similar to regular PE, including our post-investment work with the company. But yeah, we are willing to go a little bit smaller in deal size, go into sectors that are not as maybe traditional at the time of investment.
You mentioned about half the deals or equity is overseas in India. Even though you're big for impact, you're still small for sort of like global private equity. How do you manage a global deal funnel?
Most of my team is based here in the US. We have a couple team members based in Singapore that cover our Asia investments, and there's a lot of travel involved. But we're not boiling the ocean. You know, we are not investing in every part of the world. You know, we are highly selective about these two markets and maybe some adjacent. The other thing is just given the deal size, the number of deals we do, right? You know, we are not investing hundreds of millions of dollars per deal and, you know, doing 20 deals a year, right? We're doing kind of 2 to 3 deals a year and spending a lot of time on those. And so the investment funnel is a function of kind of our focus areas, as I described earlier, our kind of decade plus experience in these markets and really sourcing the deals that make most sense for kind of our risk return objectives and impact objectives to assemble that diversified portfolio, right, of relative value, one for our LPs, intentional impact, as well as companies that truly can be partners as they reach that next stage of growth.
You do have some really impressive early returns. Can you talk about what your kind of early economic returns are and what's driving that?
Now, this is a private fund, so I can't really share it. But you know, we target a net returns of high teens and gross returns over 20%. And really think about it in terms of multiple and invested capital, 2.5 to 3 times. Listen, I think there's a couple things. One, you know, we're investing in fairly high growth companies. Now, I wouldn't say all our companies grow at 100% year on year. On average, our U.S. companies grow a little slower than our emerging market companies and Indian companies. But on average, our portfolio has grown over 40% right on top line through our, you know, fund one hold period. That's a function of just kind of that capital that they've received, the primary capital that they receive has helped them build capacity to go and serve more customers profitably. And, you know, to us, building that top line growth with a focus on bottom line, particularly, you know, just given the past 2 years, how, you know, these companies were well capitalized, were able to generate cash flow to be able to back their own operations was very helpful. And so the focus continues to be, you know, getting these companies ready for their next stage. You know, in our pre-fund one portfolio, the exits we've had, we've sold to private equity. We've had companies list and we've had strategic activity in our portfolio companies. And those are all exit routes that we'll continue to pursue when we look at our, you know, fund one portfolio. They're still not all there. Some of them are further along in their path to exit, but really the realization will come in a couple of years across the portfolio. And what we're focused on for now is building that value, building that quality of earnings for our portfolio companies, and continuing to stay kind of purpose-driven, right? These companies were built to solve a problem. So as they diversify into new products, new areas, new geographies, and serving more customers, that focus on their unique value propositions needs to continue, and we continue to focus on that. You know, a point around kind of, you know, deal flow and origination, going back to kind of the DNA of the organization, you know, my business sits within a broader real assets business where I have colleagues who manage our real estate portfolios, owned and occupied real estate, farmland, infrastructure, commodities. And as you can imagine, those value chains live and breathe, you know, physical assets that can be quite carbon intensive. You know, we just, you know, as you can imagine, buildings too, you know, you really not only managing them, but powering them can be a big part of the energy utilization of an economy. And so it is quite common for us in the US in particular to back companies that in some way play in the real asset space. So, you know, we recently backed a company in the community solar servicing space, essentially bringing distributed solar to customers who don't have access to rooftop solar, for instance, right? And one of the value proposition beyond kind of being very slam dunk in our investment thesis for the green transition, we were able to also leverage and are leveraging our real estate platform, particularly our affordable housing real estate platform, where not only are we bringing this type of offering of distributed solar to the tenants in our building for net income tax credit savings to them, right, because of the framework around community solar, but also doing that for low-income customers, right, where that $5, $10 savings in the monthly utility bill really makes a difference. So I think from that perspective, that is also unique in kind of where we play, right? Because we bring the perspectives of our colleagues who operate these real assets and you know, they all need to become cleaner, greener yesterday. There is a real imperative to do that with partners who can bring them an ability to expedite that pathway.
You know, it's interesting. You're modestly said you're targeting 3 times, you know, kind of high teens net, and your average portfolio company is growing at only 40%, which are pretty strong economic return indicators. How do your LPs think about you primarily as an economic focused or more as an impact focused, or is it both?
I think it's both. I don't, you know, like you said, you know, we're not a mega PE fund, which has had, you know, LPs for, you know, our 10 funds before us, but we are selected because of our impact thesis. We are selected also because these LPs have large PE portfolios where they demand private equity returns, right? If there is a growth allocation within the LP portfolios, we'd probably be placed right there because we're a growth equity investor. We're not a buyout investor. We're not a venture investor. I think investors also look to us to help them think through what does being an impact investor look like for their portfolios long term. So the LPs that backed us for Fund One, in addition to TIA, and we're investors where we were their first impact investment in PE, right? They may have met public market investments in ESG or, you know, in green funds, but this was their first foray. They also like the fact that we bring them a diversified set of opportunities through both U.S. as well as India exposure. Frankly, I mean, they're looking at our track record and the 10 years of history we brought, leveraging the TIA portfolio and discipline, right? So we are not necessarily new to this, and that they can, we're referenceable both from a portfolio perspective as well as from our track record perspective.
One of the things you have done is put your money, proverbial money, where your mouth is, where your carry is tied to impact. And in fact, it sounds like 25% of your carry is being tied to impact based on what you said earlier. So can you discuss how you're actually doing that? It feels like lots of people are talking about putting their carry at risk, but you're actually doing it.
To be clear, we're doing this for Fund 2. Fund 1, Impact Link Carry, was still a concept that was being ruminated on in the industry. You know, we thought about kind of how would we do this if we did it. The reason for doing it is twofold. One is to do exactly what you said, put your money where your mouth is, to really stand by this thesis that purpose-driven companies can create, you know, strong financial return if managed well and if, you know, built properly and serving customers well, right? But two, also to acknowledge that there's a fair amount of skepticism from the LP and investor community around what impact really is, and whether it's just a lot of marketing, whether it's a level of just investing in the same companies and doing some actual reporting. So we thought if we built an impact link carry system, it needs to be credible, it needs to be substantial, and it needs to be something that actually relates to how we do our work. And how we do our work is when we pick companies, we have a very detailed impact diligence and ESG diligence system to even validate that this would fit our fund, right? Is it, are the revenues tied to this activity that we think is either reducing inequalities or abating the climate crisis? Is that the focus of the company? If so, what are the one or two KPIs that we should be measuring in addition to revenues and budgets and EBITDA for these companies on an ongoing basis? So that target setting muscle has already been built through pre-fund one and fund one. And in fund two, what we're trying to do is to say, well, let's be more precise about setting these targets on an annual basis and on a cumulative basis. Asset weight the companies to make sure that, you know, every time we're measuring whether we meet or we fall below, kind of, you know, it's based on the budgets of the companies. It's not based on some sort of broad target that we're setting on the onset. It's very much tied to kind of how these companies are growing. Because if our thesis is right, as these companies grow, their impact must grow, right? Otherwise, we're not doing what we're saying. So listen, there's a lot to do ahead. And we have, as we're raising fund two, we're talking to LPs about it. It has been received well. We're also going to be subjecting ourselves to some level of third-party verification of our systems and processes, which we already do, but now for impact link carry as well. And so, you know, we hope to do this in a credible way while continuing to invest exactly the way we have been.
So at investment, you're setting up the list of targets that are impact oriented, and then they're being verified by a third party. And then at exit, that third party is also coming in, or how are you actually operationalizing?
At exit, yes. But I think it's going to happen more frequently every year. You know, let's say we set a CO2 emissions reductions target for company A. We would set an annual target for that company, knowing what budget we approved, since we're sitting on the board of this company, to say, hey, here's what we approved, and this should equate to this level of carbon emissions. And if they hit their target from a budget perspective, they should also hit this, right? So they, you measure that, then you weight that metric with the four or five other companies in the portfolio every year. And you say, okay, here's how we land on an asset weighted basis. And then we do that every year until we fully exit the fund. We're a European waterfall, so we won't get paid until we hit our 8%.
Only way to do it. That's great. So you've said you've spent most of this time talking about climate focus, but you do have a second impact area, which is inequality mitigation. How would that fit into the broader climate agenda that you talked about earlier?
Yeah, listen, I think we have done over the past decade, we have actually invested a lot in more traditional inclusion-focused companies. And really, a bulk of that has happened in India. We've backed financial services companies in the microfinance space, MSME finance space, more recently housing finance, all focused on serving a low-income customer that doesn't have access to credit or is outside the formal banking system, to bring them prudent and affordable financial services, which then, in mind, lead to other things, right? For us, as we look at climate, we're not just saying we're only going to invest in climate companies and try to have them go lower income, like I described in the case of our community solar company and EcoZen, our pump company. But we also look at financial services companies and think about the climate risk they face today as they serve low-income customers. So, and can we bring in climate smart data into their underwriting models, into their portfolio models, when they face climate shocks, which they do, we all do, and they become more frequent, they're able to mitigate the risks of climate change to their portfolios. And also, we've taken some of these financial services companies and helped them develop climate smart products. So we have a portfolio company in India that my colleague Radhika sits on the board of, Kalanamporna, which is quintessential microfinance company, one of the leaders in the market, which now has a solar financing product for small scale solar on rooftops of these micro entrepreneurs' homes. It's an extension, right? We're also developing an EV product for them, EV financing product for them, right? So it's essentially bringing a core competency of lending and saving and packaging it to finance climate transition. So some are, you know, very clean and clear, easy to implement, and others require a little bit more digging. But our commitment is to both.
And you decided to make your next fund an Article 9 fund. What led you to seek that designation?
So our fund one is also a Article 9 fund. And so fund two is just following in the footsteps of fund one. Listen, we have LPs in Europe. You know, and in some cases, it is an important designation for those LPs to understand that we are following the sustainable financial disclosure regulations, the SFDR reporting standards. And we take it seriously. You know, I think one of the benefits of being a large company, which can draw on multiple resources, is we've had access to resources, consultants, advisors to tell us on how we go about this. The SFDR framework and the regulations are ever changing. They're not set in stone. So we have to be kind of adaptive with it. When we sign up for these things, we also make sure that, you know, we don't make these decisions in a vacuum from our investment decisions, right? So how does signing up to a certain set of reporting standards or regulations limit our investment universe? What we have found is that while it doesn't limit our investment universe, it requires us to be quite deliberate and open in talking with our companies and CEOs and in our deal making early about what we expect in terms of information, reporting, timeliness of that reporting, because then we have to collect that information and pass that on to our investors as part of this requirement, right? So, you know, we do have a dedicated resource on team, highly expert head of ESG and impact, Pete Murphy, who has helped us build a framework and standard that, you know, we can replicate deal over deal to be able to do this. And we also use advisors. But we're doing this once again, you know, to show the level of transparency that's required from a large asset manager like us raising an impact fund with integrity.
And you get that in your deal documents, right? So you're actually like writing into your deal documents, you will provide this information. Is that how you're doing it?
Yeah, they're in the shareholder agreements. They are appendices to that that are required by the terms of the investment. We try to be as flexible as possible to make sure that we're not throwing the kitchen sink. But often there's a lot of things that we're asking for that are not necessarily things that the company is already collecting, right? Like the KPIs are probably collecting anyway, because that's how they do business. If a pump business doesn't know how many carbon emissions they're abating by using solar, that would be a problem. But maybe they don't know kind of, you know, the gender pay gaps that we're asking them to report on, the principal adverse impacts that they need to report on quickly at a certain time frame to us. Like, these are things that we put in, and we have to do a certain level of education around it. But our companies come around, and if they don't, we don't invest.
And just really quickly, you're signatory to like almost a smorgasbord of impact reporting metrics. Is Article 9, the SFDR stuff, because of the European investors going to become the dominant one? Or do you think the others like PRI and GIN and Impact Management Project and Iris Plus and the rest where do you see this going in 3 years?
Honestly, all these things fit into different pieces of the puzzle, right? The GIN is an industry org, like ICM, right? We are part of it to grow the industry and to be part with like-minded investors. The Impact Management Project is now integrated into our impact management systems. We use it as a framework. Iris Plus is the taxonomy used to measure underlying impact metrics. The operating principles, which I sit on the elected board of, is a framework. Right? These are all actually different things, right? And I'm stating the obvious. But we try to select these pieces to fit together into an impact management system, right? This, you know, when we do impact carry or when we do SFDR reporting, we try to integrate it. It's not like a separate thing. It's part of our impact management system. We just prudently decide where it fits in. Now, let's say there was a new taxonomy that came up, a new industry org came up with that made Iris Plus obsolete. We wouldn't do Iris Plus that. We would really evaluate which one made sense. But it is, you know, I mean, what you're raising really is that the resources, time, and reporting requirements for impact investors are quite a few, and it is not lost on us, right? And it's the cost of doing business investors required of us, and hopefully over time there will be some streamlining.
Yeah, and to close out this wonderful interview, you've been inspirational to a lot of people building sort of Nuveen's private asset investment arm within a very large asset manager. And I want to throw to many of our listeners are actually students, MBA students and others who are thinking about getting into impact management. If you were mentoring an earnest recent MBA graduate who said, my goal is to get large asset holders to change their investment programs to do what Rika has done, what would you advise them to do as sort of a first job or maybe a third job?
A first job to me would be, you know, either consulting or investment banking job to go and get the skill sets to understand financial analysis, company analysis, and to understand how financial markets work, because I think that is going to be very critical in understanding motivations for why companies exist, how they grow, and what's needed. Many of the leaders in the impact space, you included, I mean, we've all come from more traditional backgrounds and then use those skill sets to go and build impact portfolios. I think the other track I would say is think consciously about whether you want to be an investor or you want to be in the science of this, right? I think there is a lot that is needed to build empirical research, evidence around impact investing. And there is a pathway for industry participants to look at that from a value add perspective. You know, when we think about value add in private equity, we always think about it as kind of operational value add, industry expertise. This is industry expertise, right? You can come into a company and help them think through ways to serve clients better, more efficiently, and drive parts of the business if you know climate science, for instance. If you understand how low-income customers behave and need products designed, these are all areas of expertise. So there is kind of the quintessential investing track, which you know, I'd advise someone, go do the hours and hours of number crunching and sim reading or creation. And then the other track is, you know, really build a unique operational expertise, because I think that's going to be much needed as this industry scales.
As someone who slept on the couch a number of times at Goldman Sachs as a financial analyst, I resemble that remark. Thank you. This was wonderful. Really appreciate everything you've done. And I know moving an org like Nuveen in the direction you're moving it is a truly impressive feat. So thank you very much for all you do, not just doing this podcast, but also in the industry more broadly. So thank you, Rika, for joining us.
Thanks, Daniel. Really appreciate talking with you today. And thanks for running this podcast. I think it certainly brings some real-life examples of what we do every day to light.
Thanks for listening to Better Money, Better World, a podcast project of Achieve Partners and Impact Capital Managers. If you enjoyed today's conversation and want to learn more about how investing for impact is driving returns, come visit us at www.impactcapitalmanagers.com.